This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and behold the sounds of the street of this nation. Here's the streets of New York. And here we go to the streets of Washington, D.C. And Oakland, California, where some of the biggest demonstrations took place this week. Talking about Michael Brown there, and of course in Ferguson, Missouri, at the center of a nation coming to grips with a deep divide between law enforcement and citizens. Speaking yesterday was Darren Wilson, the officer who told ABC News he was just doing his job when he shot Michael Brown.
The gun was actually being jammed by his hand on top of the firearm. So I tried again, and again another click. And this time I'm like, this has to work, otherwise I'm going to be dead. He's going to get this gun away from me. Something's going to happen, and I'm going to be dead. So I pull a third time, and it finally goes off.
That was the first time you'd ever used your gun, right?
Yes, it was.
Why not stay in the car? He's running away.
My job isn't to just sit and wait.
So you felt it was your duty to give chase?
Yes, it was. That's what we were trained to do.
A look now at how our justice system treats these cases and seems to have a pattern of failure to get at the issues that police and citizens believe are dividing them and building explosive tension in places like Ferguson and other communities around the country. Joining us is Judge Nancy Gertner. She retired from the Federal District Court a few years ago and is now a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Welcome, Judge.
Nice to be here.
Judge, I want to step back a little in this case. When we try to test whether an officer had a reasonable expectation that his life was in danger, that was at issue in the Michael Brown case, how much does a judge or the justice system have to take into account his training, that there are pressures and provocations that come to bear just with an officer being present on the street? And how much sophistication is there supposed to be between law enforcement and the divisions that we see across the country? Are police supposed to be aware of these kinds of things?
Well, you raise an important point. You have to separate out, on the one hand, the law that is looking only at his perceptions and whether they were reasonable under the circumstances. What should be read into that, however, may be something completely different. Perhaps one should read into that, were his perceptions out of proportion to what was going on? Were his perceptions something that, whether officers ought to be trained to deal with minor offenses that then escalate into something like this? The sad thing is that what the Supreme Court has read into the word reasonableness is very much a carte blanche for officers. So a case that was decided only 3 months ago involving an encounter with a civilian that began with a bad taillight suddenly escalated. The guy takes off and the officer follows him and then shoots 15 shots into the car, killing the driver and the passenger. And the court said that that was a reasonable response to the fleeing felon under those circumstances. So the categories are very general, and the courts have read into them really standards that privilege police, you know, erring on the side of the police officer rather than on the individual. And the issues that you're raising about training, which are terribly important, don't necessarily feed into this analysis. They may feed into a civil rights lawsuit later on. What was the training that Wilson got? What was the supervision, etc.? But for the criminal case, the question is a much more narrow one.
And the Supreme Court has really made it the case that officers are permitted to view a suspect who is acting erratically. And I say this without trying to make any sort of inflammatory conversation here, in the same way as, you know, a wild bear or someone, if he was out in the woods and there was something scary happening. I mean, the court really doesn't distinguish between danger and anger and passions that might be caused because of some sociological dynamic on the street or just this pure, you know, monster steps out from behind a tree kind of danger that it sounds like the court has narrowed in its interpretation of officers' behavior. Am I getting this completely wrong?
Well, it's an interesting parallel. I mean, it's certainly taken from the view of the officer. And if the officer doesn't make the distinction you're drawing, the court says that's fine. There's literally language in the most recent Supreme Court case about deference to the split-second judgment of police officers. Well, that framework is an important one. Yes, they have to make split-second decisions. It also then privileges overreaction, regular and sustained overreaction in the way that you describe. In addition, when you add to this what we've been reading about the stop and frisk program in New York, where young African Americans are stopped at a higher percentage than anyone else, or the broken windows theory of policing, where the notion is that you want to, want to stop turnstile jumping and all sorts of minor offenses. If you believe in that kind of policing, then the numbers of encounters between young African-American men and the police increase. If you then don't also read into this controlling excessive responses to really minor stimuli, and you allow excessive force to be used in those circumstances, then you have Ferguson, and then you have Garner, the Staten Island man, and you then have these kinds of situations.
So when people shout in crowds, they treat us like animals. It's not really hyperbole. I mean, you can sort of understand where they're coming from based on these narrow standards that the courts have built into the system. And our pathway to justice has to come from a completely different relationship between law enforcement and people on the street. Am I extrapolating, or is that a reasonable question to ask?
I think it is a reasonable question to ask. I mean, broadly speaking, what I was saying is that, given the standards, you read into those situations your prejudices. There's no question about that. If you recall Rodney King, there was a video that was a horrifying video of Rodney King being beaten up. But the jury found for the officers, because of something that was said off the video, the notion that there's things that you don't see, ladies and gentlemen, that is not on the video, and in that portion of the encounter, basically the jury read in their own prejudices, what it must have felt like to be facing someone like this. So you have to talk about retraining attitudes to the police and retraining how the police see the people that they serve. And I also think it has to be a change in the law so that courts provide incentives for this kind of accountability and this kind of retraining. If the courts are prepared to allow any kind of force to be legitimate, really, like the high-speed chase following a traffic stop with the 15 shots, then you have no incentives for police to change.
What's the path to a country that trusts its justice system so that we wouldn't have these kinds of demonstrations, in your view?
It's really critical. It's really critical that we deal with police individual encounters. We deal with racism in that way. I mean, the grand jurors, let me just sort of break it down. So the police officer says, here's what I saw. And there may be some basis for what he saw and how threatened he felt. But in fact, objectively, if you looked at it fully objectively, it wasn't true. But we give deference to his spur-of-the-moment perceptions, which essentially means I give deference to his ability to, use all his biases to deal with this young, larger African-American man. So I think that it's training. I think it's attitudinal. I think that the law has to change. I think there has to be stricter standards for when deadly force is used than we have enabled over the past couple of years.
Judge Nancy Gertner is retired from the Federal District Court and is now a senior lecturer at the Harvard Law School. Thank you so much, Judge.
You're welcome.
My name is Terrence, and I am calling from St. Louis, Missouri. I live here. Black men in particular, and black people generally, cannot receive the so-called justice that America claims to deliver.
My name's Kyle from St. Louis, Missouri. it seems like the police force is kind of a protection agency for the elite. And in St. Louis, they are the white people. And it just seems like we really disparage against the minorities in this community.
That's the view from St. Louis. It's not justice for all, it's justice for whites, some of you are saying. What about outside of St. Louis?
My name is Brian from New Hampshire. I think the cops just as soon shoot down a white guy as a black guy. It's got nothing to do with color. It's got all to do with power and arrogance.
I think part of the problem is that the country doesn't want to realize there is violence on the streets, and sometimes you have to meet violence with violence. It's not fun. It's not exciting. It's not a movie. It's real. And sometimes the outcome is tragic.
Hi, this is Tim from Philadelphia, and I think that we have to understand that too often black people are blaming white people, and it should be more so looking at blaming capitalism as a whole and what it's created in our country.
There's a lot of little young black men just gunning each other down every day for apparently no good reason. Why is the black community on fire for that as they are for this in Ferguson?
Those last two comments are more related than you might think. Two different worlds in America, and that's perhaps what's not sustainable here.
Bob from Brooklyn, New York. The system worked well in Ferguson, Missouri. Michael Brown was a thug. He committed a forcible robbery. The police officer defended himself. Case closed.
This is Barbara, and I'm calling from Jerseyville, Illinois, very close to St. Louis. And I have to say, I'm tired of this victim being portrayed as an innocent teen stealing cigarettes. This was a 300-pound aggressive man, and they don't show that video of him enough, where he shoves the guy down in this convenience store that he robbed. So it's a shame that he died, but I think any police officer would have done exactly the same thing, black or white.
My name is Peggy Nolan. I'm calling from Hollywood, Florida, and I'm appalled that we treat acting out teenage human beings as if they are some sort of lethal weapon and we have to kill them.
This is Jay from Keyport, New Jersey. The grand jury found nothing illegal about Darren Wilson's shooting of Michael Brown, and that may be the case. The conversation we need to have then is about changing the laws about what is legal for police to do. It should be nearly impossible for anyone, police or civilian, to use lethal force without consequence. The Darren Wilsons and indeed George Zimmermans of the world should not be confident that laws are on their side when they shoot an unarmed teen.
What are you hearing in those comments? Are you hearing facts and ideas that add to our understanding of what went on? Or are you hearing a parallel narrative, a parallel universe between whites and blacks, and a system that has to change? We want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us on Facebook.com/The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.